We have been looking for several months now at the subject of the Ten Commandments. We started off with some background about how we interpret the Bible, looking at covenants, looking at how some people use a particular method of having an overview of the Bible, which is completely wrong. And so we are now at the 13th message in this series, but only the 7th on the commandments themselves. And we are not looking at the 7th commandment, we are looking at the 5th commandment, because you remember we began with the 10th. The 10th informed us that all of the commandments are to be understood internally and not merely externally. And we spent 2 Sundays looking at the subject of the Sabbath. And we have been looking, as we have gone through the Ten Commandments, not only to see what they meant, but to ask the question, is this still applicable today? And when we were looking at the 4th commandment, that is, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, we saw that this was the sign of the covenant of God with Israel. That covenant has now ceased, and so the covenant sign has ceased. But there is a principle that we learn from this, that God has made man to have a day off now and again, roughly every 7th day. And if we don't have a day off every now and again, it is not good for our health. But it does not have anything to do with when we meet as a church, because each person might have a day off on a different day, but that doesn't affect the day we meet. We meet on the day that is most convenient for us, which in this country happens to be a Sunday, and it also happens to be the day on which the early church appears to have met. But it's not something that is absolute, and we must only ever meet on a Sunday. We meet on whenever it is convenient. So if we were near a hospital and the vast majority of the people in the congregation were nurses and medics, and most of them had such duties that they all had to work on a Sunday, we'd probably switch the meeting to a Saturday in order that everybody could meet together. That's a matter of practicality. It's not the day that is the important thing, it is the meeting together and resting that is important. So now we come to the 5th commandment, which you'll find in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 12. Honour your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. So this is about attitude towards parents, and beyond parents, attitude towards authority. Because ultimately, one's attitude towards one's parents reflects one's attitude towards the ultimate authority, that is, towards God. Now, immediately we can see that this commandment is also very much tied up with the covenant that God was making with the people of Israel, because of the second part of it. It says, you must do this, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. What land is that referring to? That is referring to the land of Israel. We do not live in the land of Israel. We live in England. Just quickly looking around, yes, we all live in England. So therefore, this is not saying that we will live long in England and that God has given us England. Is talking about the Israelites and their occupation of the land of Israel. Does this therefore mean that we can consign this commandment to the bin? Well, we have to ask ourselves what it means and whether it is repeated again in the New Testament. And if it is in the New Testament, clearly it is something that is still binding upon us. Now, we live in a society which for the last 50 or 60 years has suffered from the cult of youth. It all began with the invention of the teenager. Now, some of you might scratch your heads and think, hang on, surely a teenager is someone between the ages of 13 and 19 inclusive. And so if today is your 13th birthday, or tomorrow is your 20th birthday, or you're anywhere in between, you're a teenager. You can't invent that. That is merely a fact. Yes, that is true, but we're not talking about teenager in merely the sense that you are living in your teen years. We are talking about the invention of the teenager as a cultural icon, as a cultural manifestation. It was after the Second World War, suddenly there was this great prosperity previously unknown, and the young began to have money in their pockets, which they could spend on whatever they wanted. And suddenly people in manufacturing companies and others realized here was a new market to be exploited. Here is a new market where we can get the money out of their pockets and into ours. So these people also, the young, tend to be extremely gullible, and so it is easier to get money out of them than it is out of older people who think to themselves, do I really want this? Do I really need this? What is all this about anyway? No, I'm going to hang on to my money, thank you very much. The young are more gullible. It's a fact of life. Just as it's a fact that you become a teenager on your 13th birthday, it's a fact that the young are more gullible than the old. There are still old people who are gullible, but they are less gullible than they were when they were young. It's true of everybody. It's a fact of life. All of us at some point were extremely gullible, but we have learned as the years have gone by, as a result of experience, to be less gullible. We're not so easily taken in. But as a result of this recognition that the teenage market had lots of money, people began pandering to it. And even churches began pandering to it. When we were sent to a church in South London, a small church, with a membership of 7, we made 9, we were told by the minister of the church who sent us, concentrate on the youth. The youth is the future of the church. Get the youth converted and the church will grow. During 4 years, we saw 4 people hopefully converted. The youngest was 35. The oldest was 72. Which I thought very effectively demonstrated the foolishness of saying concentrate on the youth. You concentrate on everybody. But we have had this cult of the teenager, this cult of youth, for the last 50 or 60 years. I have in my iPod collection a number of songs that reflect total disdain for the elderly. I think of one particular song which really shows total disdain for the elderly and saying, look, war is a bad thing. And over the last 100 years, we've had all these wars. And it's all because of these old people. If we stopped listening to these old people, we'd have peace and harmony every day. It's naive twaddle. It's a nice song, but the words are just ridiculous. And this was common, especially in the 60s, when everything was supposed to be peace and love, man. Until 1969, when there was a festival at a place called Altamount with the Rolling Stones, and there were several people were stabbed to death in front of cameras, and they suddenly realised the dream is over. Sin affects the young just as much as the old, and this cult of youth is in fact foolish. Who would you rather drive you anywhere? Someone who has been driving for 30 years? Or someone who passed their test yesterday? Now, the person who passed their test yesterday might be exceptional. They might have a name like Lewis Hamilton. And the 30-year-old might be crippled with arthritis and can't drive at all. But as a general rule, you'd go for the older, more experienced driver because you would know that if there was a tricky situation, their experience had taught them how to get out of that tricky situation, whereas the new driver had never experienced this before. And it shows the problems of thinking that youth is wonderful and better than the old. It shows an arrogance of youth. It shows an ignorance of history. I believe it was Hegel who said, effectively, history teaches us that we learn nothing from history. Which sounds silly, and to a degree it is. But if you think about it, it's saying that each generation is cursed, or blessed as the case may be, by rerunning the faults, the problems and the difficulties of the past, because the younger generation always seem to think, oh, we don't need to listen to the old, we know better. And then they do exactly the same things and make the same mistakes that their parents, grandparents, great-great-grandparents made, because they wouldn't listen to the advice that was given. And this has become much more the case in the last 50 or 60 years in this country. Now, other countries are different. If you listen to Phil Arthur preaching on this subject, he will tell you that in the Philippines, where he has often visited, in the Philippines, you will find that when someone meets someone else who they've never met before, very quickly they try and determine their age. Because age is important. You defer to the older one. So if you discover that the person you're speaking with is a month older than you, this is an older person than you, therefore you give them greater respect. And so people spend much time trying to work out how old everybody is. I was quite amused many, many years ago when a very good friend of mine thought he was older than me. And he said, he assumed that he was 11 months older than me and said, well, come along to my 21st birthday party and tell you what, we can celebrate your 20th birthday party at the same time. I said, my 20th birthday was last year. I'm 21 this year. I'm a month older than you. His jaw dropped. What? But surely you're younger than I am. I might have been more naive than him, but no, I'm older than you. But this is what they do in the Philippines. They try and discover how old people are so that they can appropriately defer. Not like Japan. In Japan, it's a matter of status. What you find Japanese people doing, especially business people, is to find out what your status is. And so you'll find the Japanese hastily handing out business cards so they can look at the business card to see what your status is. Ah, you are managing director. Ah. And so you have to bow lower than them because you're not of such an elevated status. And the more elevated you are in status, the less you bow. The lower you are in social status, the more you have to bow. So as you're watching Japanese people, you can tell what they consider their own personal status to be. But that's Japan. The Philippines, it is a matter of age. And we find it's a matter of age in the scriptures. The cult of youth is not to be found in the scriptures. We have, for example, in Leviticus chapter 19... This is the problem of leaving this Bible in the pulpit. The pages get stuck together. Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 32. You shall stand up before the grey head and honour the face of an old man, and you shall fear your God. I am the Lord. If there is someone present who has grey hair, white hair, I believe in the Authorised Version it speaks about the hoary head, meaning white, then you have greater regard for them, because here is someone who is older than you, has lived longer than you, has more experience and probably knowledge than you, and should receive, therefore, the greater regard and the greater respect. Whereas so often these days, you would get laughed at, mocked, even spat upon by some, because you're old. Of course, there are some people who get round this by visiting the pharmacist and buying an appropriate hair colouring and trying to hide the fact that their hair is like that. And I promise you, I don't do that. This is all my real colour. And you'll find there are one or two other references in the scriptures that say exactly the same thing. Respect for the elder, the older people, the elderly. But again, you have the problem with modern culture when people say, what right does anybody have to tell me what to do? And this often comes out in the teenage years, usually with the beginnings of puberty, and people begin to have more of a self-awareness, an awareness of their own identities that they didn't have before. They suddenly begin to feel differently because the hormones are raging round the body. Things begin to happen that perhaps puzzles them at first. They don't understand what's going on. They're troubled by some of the things that happen as they develop. Suddenly they start to shoot up. And parents have the problem. Where are we going to find all this money to buy for a new pair of shoes every week? Because they outgrow them so rapidly. Are we going to allow them to walk around with long trousers that now are barely below the knee? Because suddenly their legs have become so much longer and they're beginning to look like drain pipes. And as part of this, there is this new identity as they are turning slowly into an adult. And they are beginning to see themselves as someone who is separate from their family. And ultimately, what happens is that they will find a husband or a wife and they will leave their father and their mother. And they will form a new family. But they begin to think, and this has been encouraged, that they are different from their parents. You find this amongst the cults as well. The cults are very good at this. It's a bad thing, but it's something they're good at. The JWs, for example. If the JWs get their hooks into you, they will tell you that if your parents aren't also JWs, they are of the devil. And you must cut yourself off from them. Have nothing to do with them. Because you must keep yourself pure. And so you can ignore and you can disobey your parents. But what you find is the scriptures say such an attitude, such an approach is completely wrong. There is that verse that I was looking for in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 21. And at this point, perhaps the younger ones amongst us will think to themselves, aren't I glad I am alive here and now And I didn't live, or I don't live, in ancient Israel. And I don't live in a church that believes in what is called Christian Reconstructionism, who believe that the whole of the Old Testament is still in force, except the sacrificial system. And what we're about to read is not the sacrificial system. They believe this is still in force. Deuteronomy 21, verse 18. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and though they discipline him, will not listen to them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of the place where he lives, and they shall say to the elders of his city, "This our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. On second thoughts, shall we start doing that again? I think if we did that in this country, there would be a sudden shortage of stones. We would have a serious problem of what to do with all the dead bodies. And you will remember me speaking some weeks ago on the subject of blasphemy and the heaps of stones piled up upon blasphemers. And when I went up Kader Idris with these piles of stones and said to a blaspheming boy as we walked up and saw a pile of stones, "Oh, there's another blasphemer." I walked on another 20 yards. "Oh, there's another blasphemer." What I should have said is, "Oh, there's another blasphemer or a Sabbath breaker or a rebellious son." Because there are these several things for which people could be stoned to death. Would it be a good idea to reintroduce this? I think the answer all of us would give is no, because we all know ourselves to be sinners and to be worthy of death. And so, therefore, it is something we would want to avoid. And aren't you glad that this no longer applies? And yet we find that what happens when people turn their backs upon God, one of the things that illustrates the turning of their back upon God is their attitude towards their parents. In Romans chapter 1, Paul says, verse 18, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth, because God has revealed himself to them, God has shown him to them. Therefore," verse 24, "God gave them up to the lust of their hearts." Verse 26, "For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions." And in verse 28, "And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They are filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them but give approval to those who practice them." Disobedience to parents is a consequence of turning your back upon God. If you are disobedient to your parents, then you should be worried, because it means you've turned your back upon God and God has given you up to do your heart's desire to sin. And it's a dreadful thing when people get into that situation. We see it so much around us today. But you can see from Romans chapter 1 that disobedience to parents is a consequence of a rejection of God. You'll find in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 20, John writes and says, a man says, "I love God," but he doesn't love his brother. If he doesn't love his brother who he can see, how can he love God who he can't see? We could say also that the one who says, I love God, but doesn't honour and love his parents, who he can see, clearly cannot love God who he can't see. In that chapter that we read earlier in the Gospel of Mark, and chapter 7, we see how the Pharisees had been very successful in completely overturning what God said. Honour your father and mother, and yet you say, if a man tells his father or his mother whatever you would have gained from me is korban, that is given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father and mother, thus making void the word of God. Very cunning. It sounds very spiritual. I have given all my money, all my possessions, I've given them to God. So you're not getting a penny. So when you get old and frail, and when there's no one to look after you, I won't look after you because I've given all my money to God. It sounds so spiritual, but it's heartless and callous. And it's a clear denial of the command that God made to honour your father and your mother. And this continues right to the present day. It takes various forms. Someone says, oh dear, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to leave that house that I've let you live in for all these years because, you see, I've decided that I want to support a missionary organisation. And this wonderful missionary organisation does this wonderful work. So I need to sell the house so that I can give them the money. Isn't that spiritual? No, it isn't. It's going against the teaching of Scripture. It's going against the command to honour your father and your mother. Because you should be more concerned about looking after those who are close to you than you are about those that you're never likely to ever meet. If you are a godly person, then you are concerned for your immediate family and looking after them and providing for them and doing what they need. So beware the super spiritual attitude that I can ignore everything my parents say because I'm spiritual. Now this is especially true where you have parents who are unconverted. And some people come from much more difficult backgrounds where they perhaps hardly ever see their father or hardly ever see their mother. Perhaps they are on their second or possibly even third stepfather or stepmother. And you even get situations where someone has a stepfather and then their mother dies or leaves and they're left with their stepparent and then he or she remarries and they have another stepparent. No relationship at all. And so for some people these days, it becomes extremely difficult. I mean, you must feel for these people. Their heads must be spinning. To whom do I owe allegiance? Pray for them and be sympathetic towards them. So often it is easy to despise such people because of difficult situations about which they've got no control. But we should be concerned firstly about our parents and concern for them and respecting them, even unbelievers. Let me give you an example, or a few examples. Someone is converted in their teenage years. They're converted in the context of a Baptist church. And, of course, the Baptist church says, you've got to be baptized. Parents aren't converted. Parents think, this is a bunch of complete and utter raving loonies. We're worried that you're getting involved with these people. And we're sure it won't last anyway. So what does the child do? Stuff you. God says I should be baptized. I'm going to be baptized no matter what you say. That's not honoring your father and your mother. In such a circumstance, what you should do is to actually talk to your parents and say, okay, I respect you. I respect your views. I will not get baptized until I'm 18 or until I'm 21. And then I will. And the parents will probably say, that seems quite reasonable to us because 2 years or more, that will give time for you to get it out of your system. And if you're still going after 2 years, it will show that it is well and truly in your system. And so instead of splitting from parents, harmony or some degree of harmony is maintained. I look back to when I was first converted and the way I treated my parents. It was appalling. Because I thought, well, I'm a Christian and they're not, and I've got to do what God says. So in my enthusiasm, I got things completely wrong. I made a complete mess of things. I hopefully learned from those experiences and now treat my parents in a much better way than I ever did in the past. You'll have to ask them if they think I have succeeded. Consider your parents, especially when, until you've reached adulthood, listen to their counsel and their wisdom and their advice and realize they have been there before you have. What tends to happen, and has happened for the last 50, 60 years, is that when people reach their teenage years, they reach puberty and they begin to think that they must assert themselves and say, no, I'm not going to wear that blue spotted coat anymore. I want to choose what I'm going to wear. And self-assertion sets in. And you can see from the way a lot of teenagers dress how much they are trying to be different from their parents. They are trying to assert themselves. And when you look and see the way some young people do their hair, how do they get it to stick up like that? But they want to show that they are individuals, that they are unique, that they are different from everyone else. Except if you stood them all in a line, you'd think, oh, look, all peas in a pod. When I was young, it was, we all wanted to wear Levi's to be different. So we all wore Levi's. We were all the same. And we all wanted to listen to rock music, unlike our parents' stuffy music. So we all listened to rock music. Now, anyone listen to classical music? Nah. Weirdos that do that. Of course, we all listen to the same music. All the men dressed in the same sort of clothes had the same sort of hairstyles, which in the late 60s tended to be down to the shoulders. And the women all wore the same sort of dresses, same sort of clothing, tended to do their hair in the same way. Because, of course, they all wanted to be different, but they're in fact conforming to a fashion. They might not be conforming to their parents' attitudes and tastes, they're conforming to someone else's. And unfortunately, the young don't realise this, because they don't have the understanding and the experience, and it's showing their gullibility and immaturity. Now, it's difficult for parents in such situations, I do remember seeing a programme, I think it was in the 70s, where it was trying to talk about this, and the generation gap and the generation wars, and one young teenage girl said to her friend, oh, you'll get on with my father, he's a nodding dog. And I thought, what are you talking about? But then I saw, you saw the illustration where they go in and see father, and father's saying, yes, I understand. I feel for you. I appreciate what you're going through. The nodding dog syndrome. Well, some of us still do that, and it can be caricatured. But if you're young, you need to understand that you are unique, But because you're unique, it doesn't mean you have to show your uniqueness by doing what everybody else of your age does. You can be unique just by being you. And you don't have to dress in an outrageous fashion. You don't have to get this gel that makes your hair stick out all over the place and is green, blue and purple. Some people do that, but they're doing it because they're trying to assert to their parents, I'm different. And really they're no different from anybody else because they're growing up. I wonder how many of the punks of the mid-70s are still now going around wearing black clothing and spiky, multicoloured hair and safety pins through their noses. I suspect not very many. They've grown up. So there's a word to parents as well. Your children might well go through a rebellious phase. They will usually grow out of it. But we should be considering for the children what the Bible says about how they should behave. We have the example in Luke chapter 15 of the prodigal son, the well-known story of the younger son who decides, I've had enough of this, I want my inheritance now, and goes off and wastes all his money until things turn bad and he ends up keeping pigs. And that's probably the most disgusting thing that Jesus could have said for a Jewish audience. Pigs! This unclean class of animals. How awful. And eventually the son comes to his senses and goes home. That's one of the things that parents should always make clear to their children, that home will always be home for their children, and parents love their children to bits. Some parents are better at showing it than others. Some parents never say to their children that they love them. But what they do shows very clearly that they love them. I don't think my father has ever said to me that he loves me. But I know he does. Because of the things, I could list things that he did for me when I was young that were far above and beyond anything I could possibly expect. Actually, I did expect them. But he did things for me. Never said anything, but he did things to demonstrate how much he loved me. And this is what this commandment is all about. Showing respect for parents, taking account of what parents say. And this flows on into other forms of authority. Because beyond parents, there are school teachers, there are policemen, there is the government, and above all, of course, is God. And our attitude towards our parents will reflect our attitude towards these other authorities. And if we are rebellious to parents, it is quite likely we'll be rebellious towards all these other things as well. So to parents, what is the attitude towards your parents? Are you showing them the respect that they deserve? Remember what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6 at the beginning of the chapter, where he quotes this commandment and he makes it clear this still applies to us. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honour your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. So that makes it clear this commandment still applies. Not the part about the land, because that's a reference to the land of Israel, but we should still show respect and honour to our parents. So that's what children should do. But then that's followed up with, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. Don't so over-regulate them that they feel totally crushed. There's a fine balance that parents have to learn, and I hope all parents learn it sooner rather than later. When a child is 5 years old, you probably wouldn't allow them to sit behind the wheel of the car with the engine running. Well, you might, because you'd say to yourself, their legs aren't long enough to reach the pedals. But you still probably wouldn't, because you can't trust a child of five with a car. When a child is two or three, you keep saying to them, don't stick your fingers in the electric socket, and you'll smack them if they try it, because you don't want them to electrocute themselves. But you don't do such things when a child is 16. You don't keep saying, don't stick your fingers in the electric socket, unless they're awkward and do it deliberately to annoy you, which is not unusual. But you don't, because you know that by the time they reach that age, they've got a degree of common sense and they know not to do that. There are other things that you might still talk to them about. Like a playpen. When you have a toddler, you put them in a playpen to keep them safe. As they grow, as they develop, as they get older, you take them out of the playpen, but you still give them borders, you can still give them boundaries. And they get older, and you begin to draw back and remove the boundaries. By the time a child is 18 or 21 or 25, you've removed the boundaries. You now no longer have any control over what they do. But you hope that as a result of training over many years, with the boundaries carefully withdrawn at the appropriate moment, the child has learned to be sensible, hopefully to be godly, and to live in the way in which you always hoped that they would. Bring them up and demonstrate love in practical ways, and by the way you bring them up, show them your love for them, that you're trying to preserve them and protect them. But you must learn to let go. And don't, whatever you do, become those oppressive parents who are saying, oh, you can't move out of the house yet. Oh, you're getting married. Well, you'll have to live upstairs in our house. And, of course, mother will still do all the cooking, because no woman could possibly cook as well as I can dear little Johnny. That's a generic reference, by the way. This is how people speak. And no woman could possibly ever darn your socks the right way, and so on and so forth. You have to learn to let go when an appropriate age has been reached. But to the children, you must honour and respect your parents. They have given you life. They have nurtured you, and they have preserved you. They have brought you up to where you are now. And the time for complaints about what they have done is not when you are a child. It's when you are an adult and you're able to think more clearly. When you are away from the home, when you've left home, then you can look back and you will realise just how much you've been nurtured and cared for, and what a blessing your parents have been to you. I'll let you into a secret. Parents have to close their ears at this point. Your parents were once the same age that you are now. Your parents had just the same experiences then that you have now. So when you say, but my parents don't understand, oh, yes, they do. And they know exactly what you're going through. And they know that their parents were just the same with them as they are with you. And so don't think that they don't understand. That they understand perfectly. It's you not wanting to acknowledge that fact. So do beware of going against what your parents say. This is perhaps more difficult if your parents are unbelievers, but you should still show them respect. Are you proud of your parents? This is perhaps more difficult. Some parents, your father might be a drunkard, a wife beater. Your mother might be the most obnoxious fishwife in the village. Fishwife, someone with a very loud, grating voice who expresses their opinion on everything and everyone. It's wonderful if you can be proud of your parents. And always, even if you have difficult parents, look for something good in them. The fact that they have given you life. And pray for them. If they're not converted, pray that they might even yet be converted. And remember that the time will come when they, having nurtured you and brought you up, the time will come when you have to look after them in their latter years. And remember also that behind the authority of your parents lies the authority of God. And God ultimately will hold you to account for how you have lived your life and how you have related to your parents. But the good news is that even if you have in the past despised your parents and abused them and mistreated them and disobeyed them as much as you possibly could, yet still God will forgive you if you will repent and believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and then you will desire to do what the Bible says and to honour your father and your mother.